For generations, salmon have caught us, filled us, enriched our lives, made the people strong, have fed the eagles and the bears, have haunted all our dreams and prayers. Their spirits awake in our imagination. We honor ghosts of salmon who even now struggle to continue to make the circle that supports our lives sacred and still whole.
Not long ago, I was flying back into Salt Lake City, where I live. I was flying north along the Wasatch, and the full moon came up from behind the mountains, and the whole world turned to moonlight. As I began to land at the Salt Lake International Airport, something caught my eye. What caught my eye was the moonlight reflecting off the sinuous curve of the Jordan River, winding right through the middle of the city. And it was such a remarkable testimony to the idea that wildness exists within our cities. And when we do find it, we can begin to connect with those powerful forces that reassure us that we still do have a relationship with the earth.
I like to think of urban waterways as ribbons of green throughout the Portland-Vancouver region, and virtually everybody lives near a stream. As long as they're not in North and Northeast Portland and a few other areas where all the streams have been put underground in culverts and lost. In fact, we've got, I believe the estimate is about 400 miles of streams that have been put underground throughout the region.
During the 1996 floods in Portland, Oregon, the basements and backyards of many of my Eastside Portland friends filled with water. It was a mystery to us where all that water came from. But a few years later, the Metro Council, the Portland Area Regional Government, produced a map called Disappearing Streams, which depicts the courses of 388 miles of previously existing creeks that are now underground. We think of the Willamette River that courses through the center of Portland as the river running through us. But feeding that major waterway are hundreds of invisible streams that flow beneath our feet. I'm Barbara Bernstein, and you're listening to Alternative Radio. This is the second of a special two-part series, Rivers That Were. This week's segment is called Beaver Taught Salmon How to Jump. Many years ago, I discovered a creek flowing in the hills above my house in southwest Portland. But it wasn't until I accompanied Bill Bakke of the Native Fish Society on a walk from the creek's headwaters to its historic confluence with the Willamette that I learned its history, or even its name.
We're on Markham Creek, the upper end of the hills above Portland. It's a lovely forest overtopping the creek with ferns and trees, and the creek, as you can hear, is still above ground, but soon to disappear into pipes where it will be several miles all the way down to the Willamette River. This creek back at the turn of the century was flowing all the way from the mountains above Portland into the Willamette River, one of five creeks that came together into a huge wetland complex. It was a very important area for birds as well as for fish life. As Portland developed, in the name of progress, of course, we put the creeks in pipes and buried them under several hundred feet of fill, and terraced the landscape down towards the Willamette, and we have condominiums and office buildings and parks and highways. There is no recognition whatsoever, as the land was flattened and smoothed, that the creek used to flow here. Well, we're now standing in the what used to be part of the Markham Creek Canyon. It's filled in and the creek is now in its pipe, and we have a manhole cover that you can hear the creek sluicing down through its concrete tube. Now we're walking by apartment buildings that are built on the fill over the creek. And we have a gas station and a hamburger place. Lots of parked cars, traffic, urban life. Now we're coming to a fence underneath the freeway. It's a contaminated waste site that resides on fill over the creek, and somewhere down there beyond this road closed sign that's full of graffiti and rust. The creek comes out into the Willamette in a pipe and adds its energy and flow to the great river of the West.
Most major cities on rivers view the river and its floodplain as an opportunity for industrial development.
Mike Houck, Portland Audubon Society urban naturalist.
The entire country really had a common view, I think, of swamps and wetlands as places where mosquitoes breed and were basically areas to be gotten rid of.
The wetland that Markham Creek used to feed was crucial for the rearing of the spring Chinook salmon, coho salmon, chum salmon, the cutthroat trout are all listed under the Endangered Species Act in the Willamette River. So as we gradually smooth the landscape and urbanize it, and we bury streams like Markham Creek, we end up encountering such unfortunate situations as endangered and extinct species. And once those species are extinct, there's no way that you can reclaim them. Just like it's doubtful that we'll ever be able to really reclaim Markham Creek and what it used to be like flowing through downtown Portland.
Most Western cities no longer have free-flowing creeks threading their way through the urban landscape. But one exception is San Luis Obispo, straddling the divide between Northern and Southern California.
I'd rather like to keep it a secret, but I think we live in paradise here.
Christine Mulholland's great-grandfather, William Mulholland, was Los Angeles' famous water engineer. He built the Los Angeles Aqueduct, and with water imported from the Owens Valley 200 miles to the northeast, transformed a small desert town into a major metropolitan center. Today, Christine Mulholland sits on the San Luis Obispo City Council.
We live in a really beautiful and somewhat pristine area in some ways. We are surrounded with beautiful hills and mountains, lots and lots of creeks and healthy riparian areas. There are now steelhead right in the middle of our city, and we have kind of a network of creeks around the area that pulse through, and it really does allow for a lot of peaceable places for people to visit.
San Luis Obispo lies in the center of a bowl that's the convergence of a number of creek systems and drainages.
Stephen Marks teaches English at Cal Poly University in San Luis Obispo.
Wherever you are in the city, you're no more than a block or two away from a creek that's usually about 10 or 15 feet below street level with its own little riparian ecological system.
On the banks of San Luis Obispo Creek in the heart of downtown sits Mission Plaza, a complex of restaurants, shops, and creekside trails.
The Mission Plaza area is really kind of the heart and soul of the city's downtown.
Neil Havlick is the natural resources manager for the city of San Luis Obispo.
I'm always amazed when I hear the story of the creation of Mission Plaza, which was essentially a revolt against a proposal to pave over the creek, put it in a big culvert, and put a parking lot on top of it. And there are people around today who are very much opposed to this Mission Plaza. But I don't think you would get any of them to admit it anymore today because they've seen what a tremendous success it is and what a great place it is.
San Luis Obispo Creek goes all the way to the ocean, and where it empties out is Avila Beach.
Jan Howell Marks is a San Luis Obispo city councilor.
Having a viable steelhead stream running right through our city where the fish can actually live and reproduce is a great honor because, in fact, this means that we have a pure enough environment here that they can continue to live. And it's kind of like the canaries in the mines, you know, when the steelhead can no longer live in the stream, you know that things are polluted to the point that they're dangerous for human beings.
I've walked all the creeks several times. I like to go on hikes in the creeks. I love to get my feet wet. When you're in the creek bed, you may be completely surrounded by urban development, but you're not aware of it. The sycamores and the oaks that grow in these recessed ditches that the creek flows through are large and provide a full canopy, and there's lots of birds and wildlife. It's an amazing retreat from the city.
I think that's really the challenge in urban planning, is how to factor nature into your development of a city or a town.
Bill Bakke, Native Fish Society.
And not do it like we did in the past where we just buried what were truly great amenities.
You have to reject the premise that to be urban and to embrace nature are antithetical. I think we can be very, very urban and at the same time restore the natural functions that this geography on which we're sitting serves.
Gil Kelly, Planning Director for the City of Portland.
Portland has a fairly interesting geography in the sense that the west side of the river is very hilly. And we're very fortunate that because of the physical challenges that imposes, many of the creeks are free-flowing right to within a very close proximity to the river and some directly into the river. On the east side of the river, we had lands that were drained by creeks that were more easily filled and culverted. So we have several hundred miles of creeks on the east side in particular that are now underground, and hardly anyone knows where they are, except when we do get high groundwater levels, people are pumping their basements out and wondering, why is this happening?
On the west side of Portland, we have Fano Creek.
Dean Marriott, the Director of Environmental Services for the City of Portland.
As Fano Creek watershed developed, people built right up to the edge of the creek, big parking lots, apartment buildings, shopping centers, and everything else. The creek was viewed more as a nuisance than an asset. What we're finding now is the best way to restore that watershed is to find an alternative way of handling all that massive stormwater that runs off of those developments. And so we're trying to go back in and put more vegetation in along the stream, provide that sort of filter buffer between the water itself and the source of the runoff, and then put trees and greenery to try and break up these big impervious surfaces.
The Endangered Species Act has recently listed two salmon species that depend on Portland's Willamette River and its tributaries for its spring and fall migrations. So using those as sort of indicator species of the general health of the urban watershed is a way to begin to inform us very specifically about how we can reincorporate habitat right in the urban environment. And I think that Portland's real identity does come from the fact that it is a city within nature.
Well, we're at Oaks Bottom Wildlife Refuge, which is the first official wildlife refuge in the city of Portland. So if you consider, we've got a 160-acre ecosystem here consisting of open water, emergent marsh, riparian swamp, and upland habitat in the heart of the city. It's pretty phenomenal, which is why we've seen upwards of 115-20 species of birds. I'm hearing green-winged teal. They love this shallow water, muddy habitat. Oh my God, there's another 10 or 15 herons. Got a runner coming through. When Lewis and Clark came through here, this was all open to the Willamette. Sometimes of the year, it would have been totally inundated with water. In the early 1900s, the interurban rail line was put through in between the bottoms and the Willamette River. So that separated the bottoms from the river, with the exception that they left a large pipe that allowed water and still allows water to go into and out of the bottoms. We have a water control structure to allow us to fluctuate the water levels so that in the spring and in the fall, the open water is much less than it was during the summer. The reason for that is we want these exposed mudflats for the shorebirds and other species that are migrating through. Ironically, before we got a chance to put the dam in, beaver moved back in. And it's the beaver that dammed this area up. The beaver dam, we aren't really able to regulate the water in the manner we wanted to. And so the first strategy was to tear the beaver dam out. Well, they immediately replaced it. Then a pipe was put in to drain water from behind the dam, and the beaver put their butts up against the pipe and crammed it full of mud. And so they thwarted us again. So finally a pipe was put in that had perforations in it that allowed water to continue to flow. And then we could go ahead and start managing with our own man-made dam.
Oaks Bottom is the last natural riparian area along the Willamette River as it continues its journey through Portland. A mile downstream from where Mike and I were birdwatching is a large island, which has been hollowed out from 75 years of gravel mining. From then on, both sides of the river are heavily industrialized as it wends its way through downtown Portland. In late winter of 2001, Portland's Mayor Vera Katz announced in her State of the City address a sea change in the city's relationship to its central river.
For over a generation, we lived with the myth that we honor and care for our Willamette River. but it's time to look our history straight in the eye and admit the sad truth. A disfigured and sickly river still runs through Portland.
The river that runs through us is our reason for being. We're a very active port that serves a very broad region. To accommodate that function, we put freeways right alongside of the river, railroads right alongside it, sea walls for flood control that divorce human activity from the water's edge. That's a legacy that we have created for ourselves in the last 100 years or so, and those are the elements that we need to turn around.
I embrace the River Renaissance vision. A vision that includes a vibrant waterfront with trails, urban plazas, restaurants, marinas, surrounded by public art, where the Willamette is a place for walks and bicycles, boating and swimming and fishing, a place where all the Portlanders have easy access to the water's edge, where we reconnect with our history and the soul of our city. It's a vision where the river is clean and healthy for fish, wildlife, and people, with restored habitat, clean water, and abundant salmon.
The vision of the River Renaissance was inspired by Portland's planning director, Gil Kelly.
We're in many ways undoing 150 years of urban development here, and it's going to take us many decades, maybe another 150 years to achieve a more balanced state between the natural and urban environment. The primary objective in the central part of the city is to really kind of break down these hardened embankments we have on either side and get people down to and out onto the water. On the east side of the river, looking across the water at downtown, we've recently constructed an esplanade. But right behind it, and compromising your experience there, is an 8-lane interstate freeway.
We need to restore the riverbanks. We need to remove some of the development along it, plant some riparian areas on the edges, reduce the sewer overflows into the river. This is going to take a lot of work, but I think having things like peregrine falcons here is a reminder of why we want to do it.
Throughout the spring, you can find Bob Salinger, the director of the Wildlife Care Center at the Portland Audubon Society, standing on the bank of the Willamette River with his spotting scope.
We are standing under the Fremont Bridge on its west end, observing peregrine falcons. Peregrine falcons have been on the Fremont Bridge since 1993, and they've been nesting here ever since. The first year they raised young was 1994, and since that time they've raised 18 young here. 12 of those are known to have survived. Typically, falcons nest on cliff sites in the wild, but since their reestablishment in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, they've also been found on skyscrapers and bridges. Having peregrines in downtown Portland helps expand our definition of what wildlife habitat is. We spent a tremendous amount of energy preserving and protecting habitat, and we actually have significant wildlife populations. Seeing these birds reestablish themselves in the middle of the city, flying around and landing on the girders, living off introduced rock doves and starlings, that is pretty magical. Here we go, we got one flying, and it's landing on an I-beam right next to the nest. That's the male. The female is on the nest right now, and she's brooding her young. Come back in 4 weeks and see them when they're fledging.
10 miles from the peregrine falcon's nest on the Fremont Bridge, we come to the confluence of the Willamette and the Columbia Rivers. Standing on the tip of a narrow peninsula looking upstream, to your right you see a sandy beach, and right around the bend are miles of ships and docks. The Willamette, which begins 200 miles away as glacial melt in the Cascade Mountains, ends in the polluted Portland Harbor, where 150 years of industrial waste has accumulated. To your left, you see the stretches of sandy beach and islands of the Columbia River, which begins 1,100 miles to the north and east in the Canadian Rockies. Writer Tim Palmer has canoed most of the river's length.
I went to the headwaters at Columbia Lake and found the very uppermost tributaries to this river that come from wonderful wilderness landscapes of the Purcell Mountains, the Caribou Mountains, the Canadian Rockies. But where the river actually begins is in a lake that's fenced off for cattle, and there's a hard-working sawmill right nearby clanking away. And at the very outlet of that lake, there's a golf course. Here, as the river just begins, you can hit a ball across the river on 7 different holes.
The Columbia River carves its way through a landscape that is volatile and young in geologic years. During winter storms, when the east wind surges down the gorge, you can sometimes watch the landscape change before your eyes. For the past 15,000 years, cataclysmic events have been shaping the land. The Missoula floods, a series of more than 40 catastrophic floods, swept across the northwest from Montana, beginning about 15,000 years ago and lasting for 2,200 years. They sculpted the coulees and scablands of central Washington and the pinnacles and spires that define the Columbia Gorge. Volcanic activity is as recent as the eruption of Mount St. Helens in 1980. But people have lived on this landscape for over 10,000 years as well. When you talk to Native people, they will tell you that they have always been here. This ancient society centered around Salado Falls, a roaring cataract on the Columbia, where the river narrowed, turning on its side into a magnificent waterfall. In the spring and summer and fall, salmon clustered at the base of the falls, preparing to make the great leap over the falls on their journey home. Today, the roar of Celilo has been quieted by the backwaters of the Dalles Dam.
We had to compete against the sound of this water, and it flowed here. And why we were here, it was a great event for us to be here. It was the center of all the life that we knew. When this dam went in, the Dalles Dam, it destroyed that. And many of our people, they lived here along this river. The ceremonies that we go through every year, we pray for our foods and the illnesses that our foods have to endure, the sicknesses that they have to go through. And we honor these foods and we pray that they can come back here to us so that we can continue to exist just as our ancestors have existed on these lands.
Randy Settler, chairman of the Yakama Nation's Fish and Wildlife Committee, was one of the speakers at the blessing of the fishing house at the Celilo Tribal Fishing Site in April 2000. When the Bonneville Dam was finished in 1937, it inundated one of the most significant tribal fisheries on the Columbia. To mitigate this loss, the Army Corps of Engineers promised to build several new fishing sites for the tribes along the river. 63 years later, the fishing house at Celilo was the first of these promised sites to be completed. One of the speakers at the ceremony was General Strock, a Brigadier General in the Army Corps of Engineers.
First, let me say that I'm honored to be here today. To the tribal leaders and to the elders, it is a great honor for me to participate this morning. This is a sacred site for the river people, in fact, for all the native peoples of the Northwest. This Celilo Falls was the spiritual and economic center for this region. And I think it's fitting that we conduct this ceremony here today. This is a time of sadness, I think. We certainly recognize the impacts that have been felt by this region and by these peoples. But I also hope that our celebration today, this commemoration of this park and this artwork, also serves as a sign of hope for us. Well, just another sign of the white man's noise that he's brought to the valley here. I'm sorry.
I am Lillian Pitt. My Indian name is Wakamu. I'm Wishram and Wasco and Cascade. This place used to be a sandy beach, and we used to go swimming around here, and we called it Salmon Head Beach because there were always salmon heads around. Everything smelled of salmon, all different shapes of salmon. I mean, dead salmon, rotten salmon, fresh salmon, dried salmon, baking salmon. The mingle of the salmon just seemed to just go through your every pore. And then Celilo Falls was further down, about a half a mile, and you can just hear the roar. There were always fishermen. The women were gathering the fish and walking from the falls up to the village, and then they would carry these heavy, heavy fish. There was a pulley car where they would put the salmon inside the pulley car and go across, and it was also a way of transporting the fishermen. Another little friend and I can't remember who it was, but we went across in that pulley car, and it was so scary. I mean, it was right over the bottom part of the falls, and all that white water was just so scary, and it was so much fun to be so scared. It was a place that I took for granted, like Mount St. Helens, you know, you always took that for granted. And now that her top's gone, you can hardly remember, you know, what it really looked like. And so it's kind of like one of those memories. But I can feel the mist from the water coming and hitting my face and feel the cold and hot sand and the smell and then seeing it and hearing it. When you get all the senses going, you can really, really feel the place.
Salado Falls is still there. It's just underwater right now. There will be a time when it comes back again.
Donald Sampson is the executive director of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission.
Coyote, in the previous times, has broken through the dams. He freed the fish. It's, you know, quite an elaborate story. It gives this generation of people some hope and inspiration that they will once transform themselves as Coyote did so that we can break the dams. There's going to be a grandchild of mine or somebody's that's going to say, these dams are going to go and Salila will return, just like Coyote did.
The once wild Columbia is now a series of slack water reservoirs for most of its journey from the Canadian border to the Bonneville Dam, 40 miles upstream from Portland. A series of dams have transformed this river into a highway for barges and other commercial traffic. On a hot day in late summer, I ride on the legend from the Bonneville Dam to the Dalles Dam, a journey of about 50 river miles. This tugboat, owned by Tidewater Barge in Vancouver, Washington, is pushing a tow of three barges. Jerry Timmons, a deck mechanic, stands on the deck with me describing how he loves to go whitewater rafting, while we chug along on a flat water surface concealing the roaring rapids and spectacular falls which once made this river so treacherous to navigate. He tells me how he fantasizes about rafting over Salado Falls.
I have only seen pictures of Salado Falls. I was never fortunate enough to take that journey east and see it for myself, and I missed out. But I realize that the economy has to move. I realize that we have to progress in our society to do that, and we've created something else.
I'm Larry Bartell. I've worked here at Tidewater for a little over 29 years. I actually spend more time out here on the river, watching over the river, so it becomes like your home, and you want to take care of it like your home.
Mike Warren, I'm pilot on the Legend. We're pushing a barge 3, which is going to the Snake River Terminal, fuel for the Tri-Cities. In front of that, we have a solid waste barge, which is going to a landfill. It's Vancouver's disposables. On the port side of that, we have a barge that's going to the Cargill grain elevator at the Dalles. Farmer's product will be hauled in it back down to Vancouver and shipped to foreign ports.
This is the cheapest and most efficient form of transportation. It takes advantage of the current going down river when you're hauling heavy loads. It saves on fuel. It helps the environment in the sense of there'd be millions of trucks rolling in and out of Portland if it weren't for the river transportation. So one has to be real aware that you know, we do a great service to make things happen for the economy, and it's steady, employs a lot of people. And so as the strength of the port is kept good, then it pays tax dollars, supports the schools, and it's all around good for everybody.
The development of hydroelectric power in the Columbia River Basin has had the most profound impact of any other human activity, and that is what has brought about the threatened demise of what used to be the world's largest Chinook salmon and steelhead runs.
Ed Cheney is a natural resource consultant who lives near Boise, Idaho.
These large projects simply blocked anadromous fish from vast areas of the basin. Probably something on the order of half or more of the entire area once accessible to these migrating fish is no longer accessible as a result of dam construction.
There is nothing in the Columbia Basin that is natural any longer.
Jim Athern is a fish program planner for the Northwest Division of the Army Corps of Engineers.
Maybe not nothing, but very little is natural. This is a basin that has been thoroughly developed and utilized by the millions of people that have moved in, and now everybody wants to turn around and say, We want fish and habitat the same as it was before all the people, but none of us want to leave.
He winds down the Granite Canyon and bends across the lee like a prancing, dancing stallion down her seaway to the sea. Cast your eyes upon the biggest thing that built by human hands on the King Columbia River. It's the big Grand Coulee Dam.
It was all a part of the American plan to just capture the West.
Louis Pitt is the Government Affairs and Planning Director of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon.
Very little thought at the time was given to trying to protect some of the free-flowing natures of those streams and wildlife habitat that was lost and the way of life that was lost by people like our folks that depended on fishing on the Columbia River.
I wouldn't agree that we didn't think that they were important. Even when we built Bonneville Dam back in the 1930s. We included fish ladders because we wanted to pass those fish safely and keep them moving in the migration.
During the early 30s, when they started building Bonneville Dam, there was no design for fish ladders there.
Jerry Westerholm is a commercial fisherman in Astoria, Oregon, near the mouth of the Columbia River.
And every person in Astoria that was alive then said if it wouldn't have been for the fishermen and the canneries, they wouldn't have put one there. The famous quote by a Corps of Engineers guy in 1932 was, "We're not here to nursemaid fish, we're here to build dams."
And the tribes had to just really push darn hard to get what fish ladders we could get at Bonneville, and they were the minimal. You know, later the biggest dam on the Columbia, the Grand Coulee, has no fish ladder at all. It wipes out, I think, 1,200 miles of prime habitat for salmon and steelhead. America at that time saw a cheap power and then the political power and military power that it has as being the priority.
Green Douglas fir where the waters cut through. Down her wild mountains and canyons she flew. Canadian Northwest to the ocean so blue. It's roll on, Columbia, roll on. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Your power is turning our darkness to dawn. Roll on, Columbia, roll on.
The big pain for the fishermen was when they put Grand Coulee Dam in and cut off what were colloquially called big June hogs, because they were a large salmon, up to 80 pounds. When those things quit coming, it hurt economically too, because those were prime canning fish.
Actually, there were people at the time who were concerned about the impact on fish and how the salmon would not be able to continue their customary migration.
Diana Cross is the Regional Public Affairs Officer for the Pacific Northwest region of the Bureau of Reclamation.
And so when Grand Coulee was built, the Bureau of Reclamation at the same time built mitigation hatcheries to make up for the fact that those runs would no longer be able to go up the river. And it was thought at the time by all the fishery biologists, not just the engineers with reclamation, that this was an acceptable substitute, that a hatchery fish would perform just as well as a wild fish.
They had a plan that they were going to catch them and then transplant them in the Metaho River, which is right next to Grand Coulee Dam there. They put them over there, but they didn't reproduce. They wanted to go to Canada.
After Grand Coulee Dam was built, it blocked the spawning habitat upriver from there. And as a result, there was no longer any reason not to build other hydropower plants on the river downstream from Coulee. So even if it were possible to spend, probably in today's dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars to retrofit Grand Coulee Dam to allow fish passage, they'd still have to get past seven other main stem Columbia River dams before they even got there. Some of those dams have fish ladders, but not all of them.
They came to rely fairly quickly on hatcheries and harvest regulation.
Fisheries biologist Jim Likatovich is author of Salmon Without Rivers.
Hatcheries fed fish into the fishery. The fishery was regulated to allow enough fish to return back to feed the hatchery to start the cycle over again. The hatchery component of this simple production system was supposed to replace the need for habitat.
All salmon really require, in terms of habitat requirements, are good gravel, clean water, cool water.
Jeff Fryer is a fisheries scientist for the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission.
One of the ways you get cool water is to keep the water shaded. If it's really exposed to the sunshine, then it's going to warm up a lot more. It helps if the area hasn't been logged or hasn't been grazed or hasn't been irrigated.
taking water out of streams, cutting down trees, farming, taking out groundwater flows. All those things cause the temperatures to go up.
Nina Bell is the executive director of Northwest Environmental Advocates in Portland, Oregon.
There's this mismatch between what salmon need and what we have. And then there's this kind of overlay of what we've done to the habitat and the complexity of the streams and how that complexity actually supported salmon even when the water got hot.
As part of learning how to live in a crazy quilt patchwork of a lot of habitat diversity from rainforests to deserts to high altitude to low elevation, salmon developed a lot of different survival strategies, and those survival strategies are called their life histories. The fact that they had a lot of different pathways through the environment meant that at any one particular time, if there was a problem, if one of those pathways was blocked or it was no longer conducive to survival, they would have alternatives that they followed. And some of them would survive and they would remain fairly productive. This diversity wasn't a benefit in the hatchery program, so we had to get rid of it, strip it away. If we were going to rely on artificial propagation, it's much better in a hatchery if all the fish do the same thing at the same time. They move through the system like cows through a feedlot.
The agricultural and industrial needs of Western settlers have simplified a once complex natural river system. But long before the Army Corps of Engineers rearranged the landscape and hydrology of the Columbia River Basin, beavers were nature's engineers, and they played an important role in shaping and maintaining salmon habitat.
There's a bumper sticker that says, "The beaver taught salmon how to jump." The beaver did a lot of things that helped improve salmon habitat. The reservoirs that they backed up helped create wetlands, helped to modulate the flow fluctuations. The beaver dams backed up pools that were extremely important for summer rearing during low flow periods in desert areas. Beaver ponds provided refuge during high flows in the winter.
Beaver ponds are among the most productive coho salmon habitat for rearing. These fish jump, they can get over the dams or maybe migrate upstream when there's high flow and there's crack in the dam or whatever. The dams aren't likely to provide much of an upstream obstacle for them, and they do trap all the sediment. So immediately downstream of a beaver dam, you'd expect that maybe you would have better gravel than you would if you didn't have the beaver dam there and the sediment that gets trapped behind the beaver dam was running through the system.
My uncle, who was a BLM road engineer, would come down here when the beavers built dams and say, "Oh, they don't really know what they're doing, though. That'll wash out by winter."
Steve Johnson is a watershed activist, environmentalist, and teacher in Milwaukee, Oregon.
Well, they don't care if it washes out. Where the main reason the beavers have the dam is for the low water conditions, and they just want the water high enough so that it protects their entrance. So in the winter when the water's high, they don't care if the dam holds up. They just rebuild it again in the spring.
Well, I'll tell you a story. When I was working on the Olympic Peninsula, I was doing a survey of this one stream, and it had a big beaver dam on it. And I knew this wasn't a new dam. So I followed it fairly closely and watched it. And then after a while, you began to see fish down below the dam, but it was obvious they weren't getting above it. It hadn't started raining. The flows were still low. Then after the first couple of real heavy rains, the dam opened up just like it was hinged. The dam, instead of being across the river, was laying along one side of the creek. That particular part of the river was full of water, and I'm sure it was deep enough for the beavers still to hide in. And whenever the flows would drop, all the material was still there. They just put it back, rebuild their dam, but the fish had gone up. So you might say the beaver had a green design in their dams.
What would the river system look like if the Army Corps of Engineers were to take some cues from the beaver in redesigning the hydro system on the Columbia River?
I've heard people suggest that you could get a decent amount of hydropower out of the Columbia Basin without building such big dams. If you could, instead of having 9 big dams, have 90 small dams. The barge people wouldn't like it, having to go through all those little itty-bitty locks. But if you could have 90 small dams instead of 9 big dams on the main stem Columbia, I suspect the salmon would probably do a lot better.
When you start doing things that don't allow for enough escaping of fish upstream, then of course you create this incredible disharmony.
Gail Tremblay, artist, poet, and teacher at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington.
Because you live in a world where the fish don't only feed the human beings. They feed the eagles and the bears and even little animals and bugs that eat those carcasses when they get up there. The bears fertilize the places they leave the bones and the carcasses, the parts they don't devour. That fish becomes a fertilizer for the forest along the stream beds that shade the streams and keep them cool for the fish. And when you disturb that relationship
and you don't allow all of those things to happen, then everything in the circle, not just the human being, starts to suffer and things get out of balance.
The loss of beaver, the loss of riparian vegetation, the loss of water through irrigation, the grazing of the riparian areas in the desert, all of these things tended to change the habitat, simplify it, and in the process it eliminated a lot of these different alternative survival strategies, these life histories.
Fisheries biologist Jim Likatovich.
If you're really going to rebuild productivity and sustainability, you've got to allow for enough habitat rehabilitation to allow the salmon to rebuild these alternative survival strategies back into their natural production cycle. We have to restore the ghosts of some of these old life histories that we've eliminated. And there are a lot of those ghosts that are running around out in the Columbia River now that we need to pay attention to.
Below the Bonneville Dam, the river flows unimpeded to the ocean, 140 miles away. As it courses through the steep conifer-studded walls of the Columbia Gorge, the Columbia widens and tidal influences become evident. 40 miles from its mouth, the river enters a unique mixing zone with the ocean, a brackish reach known as the estuary. Along this estuary in the old fishing town of Astoria, Oregon, 10 miles upstream from the river's mouth at Cape Disappointment, I met Peter Hudala, a river activist who grew up with the river in Astoria.
The Columbia River rushes down through a gorge, widens and progresses in a more and more mighty fashion until at a spot about 40 miles from the mouth, it stretches its wings, if you will, and flows off into corners, into channels, into sloughs, into bays.
The Columbia estuary, I think, is really unique because there's so much energy going through, coming from Montana, from Wyoming, and Canada, and that collects all that fresh water and collects all the influences, whatever they are. They could be natural processes or they could be man-made processes. So we are at sort of the receiving end of a lot of conditions upstream. At the same time, we're pretty exposed to the ocean conditions as well.
Alan Whiting is the wetlands coordinator for the Columbia River Estuary Study Task Force in Astoria.
The energy of the system is just astounding. If you go over the bridge of the Columbia Estuary, you'll see just, I mean, how much volume is coming through here and how it makes for a very delicate ecosystem as a result.
The estuary is important for salmon because that's where they make their transition from freshwater to saltwater. But then it's also important to a whole range of other species and migratory waterfowl and mammals and other birds.
The tide in this estuary region sometimes moves up and down 10 feet and twice a day. In the course of that, areas of tidal swamp and backwaters of the tributaries and bays of the river fill and empty. The complexity of the river system, as remarkable as it is now, is only a fraction of what it was 100 years ago. 70% of the tidal marshlands of the lower 46 miles of the river have been lost due to dredging, diking, filling operations. We've tended to simplify the river for human purposes. And we've actually made the situation so far worse for the environment that we're paying a human consequence.
Currently, to maintain the mouth of the Columbia River, the Army Corps dredges 5 million cubic yards a year of sand at the mouth of the Columbia River, and that sand is deposited in ocean disposal sites right off the mouth of the Columbia River.
Matt Van Ness is the director of the Columbia River Estuary Study Task Force.
It's proven a problem not just from a habitat standpoint, also a wave amplification standpoint. They've dumped so much dredge material at one site called Site E off the north jetty of the Columbia River that it's actually raised the ocean floor and has increased the size of the waves where it's already quite treacherous.
In order to find room to accommodate the millions of tons of sand that have to be dredged from the river every year to maintain the channel to Portland, dump sites need to be developed. And one of these dump sites was a creation of an island in the estuary. This was considered to be a beneficial use because this would provide habitat for certain types of wildlife. Well, as it turned out, one particular species of wildlife found this island particularly attractive. It's called the Caspian terns, the largest tern in the world. Well, they enjoyed this new island that we built in the river so well that before long there was a colony of over 20,000 Caspian terns. And guess what? This island happened to be right in that area of the estuary where the salmon smolts linger before they go to the sea. And the Caspian terns loved the salmon smolts and ate them up by the millions.
Bryce Island is a story of what not to do with dredge spoils. When you go in and you try and fundamentally alter something as big as the Columbia River, you are going to create problems that you couldn't imagine in the first place. Because they recognized that they would face legal problems if they tried to continue to dump in wetlands and dump too much into the river itself, they are now switching over to the idea of dumping a lot on what they call the uplands, on already dry surfaces. Yet that also poses various problems because that's still habitats that's getting smothered. Really, wherever you dump a bunch of sand, something's going to get smothered, whether it's juvenile crab in the ocean or the living area of sturgeon or what have you. Messing with Mother Nature, I think, is just inherently dangerous.
In addition to the ongoing maintenance dredging of the river, the Army Corps was trying to push through a plan to do further dredging that would deepen the shipping channel from Astoria to Portland by 3 feet. Nina Bell, Northwest Environmental Advocates.
The rationale is that in order to maintain our Pacific Northwest share of shipping, we need to be able to accommodate larger ships because around the world, ships have been getting bigger and bigger to achieve efficiencies. Studies may show that an additional 3 feet of depth of the river isn't going to be the end of the world for salmon or any other species, but it is, as the National Marine Fisheries Service put it, an incremental insult to, you know, an already degraded environment.
The plan that was outlined in the Environmental Impact Statement for Channel Deepening outlined a 50-year disposal plan to dump a Panama Canal and a half of dredge material in the nearshore ocean off the mouth of the Columbia River.
The estuary is in terrible shape from historic dredging, historic diking of wetlands and other low water habitat, and of course the Columbia River dams. And then you add on top of that the fact that the salmon have basically been depleted for a variety of reasons. Add on top of that then the pollution that is coming down from the entire Columbia River basin and then coming to reside in the Columbia River estuary. And so overall, it's very difficult just to separate, well, this 3 feet of additional dredging from the backdrop of a terribly degraded habitat.
We've not opposed the project. We've opposed the way the project has been planned through the environmental impact statement that outlines how the project's going to occur. The Corps proposes to dredge year-round for 2 years and not break for salmon migration, which every dredging project on the West Coast abides by in what are work periods to avoid impacts to salmon. Also, the ocean disposal portion of the project is problematic. The Columbia River is the most treacherous bar crossing in the United States, and the Corps and EPA still don't have a long-term plan about how to deal with maintaining the mouth of the Columbia River and maintaining the sediments that are dredged from that area. So at the same time they're having trouble maintaining the mouth of the river, they're talking about creating a new project for them, and they don't even maintain what they have very well.
Back on the Tidewater Barge's tugboat, Port Captain John Piggott has a different view on channel deepening.
If you're going to be in the port business, then you have to be able to provide access to modern vessels. And of course, like everything else, they're getting larger, and that means deeper drafts. If the channel is left alone, eventually that becomes less attractive to ship traffic for coming in here, because they can only load to a certain point, which frequently will not be the maximum limit of that vessel. Economically, that's a non-starter for people in the ocean shipping business. When you're living in an area that is serviced by a major deep water port, you tend to lose sight of the fact of how many jobs are connected to that and what an economic lift it provides to the region.
It's arguable whether or not deepening the shipping channel in the Columbia all the way to Portland will help that city's port to thrive. But many fishermen and their advocates in Astoria believe that channel deepening will hurt the fishing industry in Astoria and be the final nail in the coffin of their town's declining economy. Peter Hudula.
Astoria was a town that was built by salmon. The abundance of the salmon populations in the late 19th century in the Columbia River were unparalleled anywhere in the world. And once canning was developed, the place absolutely boomed, because this seemingly endless abundance of salmon could now be packaged and shipped anywhere in the world.
Well, my name is Jerry Westerholm. I was born and raised along the banks of the river. The salmon is part of the culture that I grew up in. In times, it provided a good living for people. It was your lifeline, just like the native tribes before us. There was always the odor of canned fish. I remember there was at least three marine stores, whereas there's really only one now. And they all did pretty good business. Seemed like there was a dozen restaurants on Commercial Street, and the canneries employed 500 or 600 on their canning lines when they were going full speed. And the cannery workers, the women with the white bandanas on, and you see them at lunchtime, you know. And there was a whole society built around each one of those canneries.
As a child, I could walk the waterfront, and there'd be cannery after cannery after cannery. Now, I just walked the streets and docks of Astoria and looked at the piling falling into the river that were the remains of what were canneries. And it kind of brings back the ghost.
One day I was out sitting on the bank of this river in the late winter. I noticed the shadow sort of moving in the water, and it was a Chinook salmon.
Fisheries biologist Jim Likatovich.
She was trying to spawn, and it was basically a shelf of bedrock. And she was going through the motions of spawning. I watched her for I don't know how long, but she was basically following her instincts, except she was in the wrong place, and she was beating herself to death on this rock. I saw the futility of it and how the whole world had changed and left this animal still trying to follow its instincts, but in a futile way that was going to end in its death without accomplishing what its purpose was. And at the same time that I was looking at this river, I was reading a book describing the Indian ghost dancers that believed that the world was changing for them also. A whole new culture was taking over, and they thought maybe by the power of their dance they could restore things that they saw were slipping away from them.
For generations, we have caught salmon dressed in lovely flesh, skin shimmering with scales, bellies iridescent as pearl covering glorious coral-colored muscle that quivers while fish shimmy upstream. Only the strongest swim past our nets and traps at the end of a remarkable migration to make new life, to pass on wisdom in simple cells, to make eggs like small translucent orange jewels grow fertile in tender gravel beds at the heads of streams that hover in the body of memory through years of travel in open ocean. Grown, adults will swim like their parents, miraculously, some to us, some past, on their single journey home to spawn.
Beaver taught salmon how to jump is the second of a two-part series, Rivers That Were. This program was written, narrated, and produced by Barbara Bernstein. Don Fisher was production assistant. Original music was composed and performed by Barbara Bernstein. Additional music was by Igor Stravinsky, Robbie Robertson, Woody Guthrie, George Crumb, and Jim Pepper. To the Ghosts of Salmon was written and read by Gail Tremblay. The Sounds of Salado Falls are courtesy of the Columbia Gorge Discovery Center at the Dalles. Special thanks to Elaine Velasquez, Jerry Mayer, Gail Tremblay, Lillian Pitt, Beth Hyams, Ron Robertson, Tammy Dean, Kathleen Collins, and Aaron Andrade. This program was funded by the California Council for the Humanities, the Washington Commission for the Humanities, the Oregon Council for the Humanities, the Regional Arts and Culture Council, the Paul Robeson Fund, the Ralph L. Smith Foundation, the Utah Humanities Council, and the Nevada Humanities Committee. Rivers That Were is dedicated to the memory of Senator Paul Wellstone.